It's on like a, it's like a Civil War style horse, and it's rearing back, and it's right on the Monument Row right down there in Richmond, which of course has all these statues of these famous generals and these awful people. I shouldn't say awful. No, I
guess. Yeah. It's all right.
I mean, slave owning equals awful. But hi, everybody. Welcome back to our podcast, Everything That Rises, all about the short stories of the one and only Flannery O'Connor. My name is John Meehan. I'm an English teacher, an author, a speaker, a presenter, a writer, a nerd, and a lover of books. And each week I bring people on who have some part of their pedigree that involves something involving the stuff I just said to talk about the short stories of this amazing, iconic author of the 20th century. She's an icon of the American South, icon of the Catholic tradition, and really, for my money, maybe one of the best short story writers in the history of the world. But maybe I've overstated it. So to call me on my ish, or to like back me up, drink the Kool-Aid with me. You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Christopher Michalski, and I'm a scholar of crime fiction and Southern fiction, actually. And I work at Louisiana State University as both a teacher and as a writer and editor. And I, you don't have to back off that claim at all. I think you can definitely say she's absolutely one of the best short story writers ever.
And you know, to back up your claim, you mentioned you are a scholar. You're being modest. You have a PhD in English.
I do indeed. Yeah. I do indeed.
So you have to believe him, guys, right. Because what he says has letters after his name.
Whenever somebody asks for a doctor in the house, I always show up and, you know, anything need any analyzing?
Perfect.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? Dr. Oz and Dr. Phil can be on the Costco circuit. You can do anything. My mom is funny. I was talking to my mom about writing. I wrote a book, which is not about Flannery O'Connor. Should have been. But my mom says, it's good, but it's a book about teaching. She's like, when are you going to write a book, you know, with like a plot? I'm like, there we go. That's what I needed to hear in my life. That's good. I don't pretend to know anything, but I did write a book. Someone one time, I think it was Gary Vaynerchuk, the investor, tycoon, social media entrepreneur. He said on Twitter, he goes, I don't pretend to be an expert. I pretend to be IHOP. I have ideas, hypotheses, opinions, and predictions. You can take them or leave. And that's what I bring to today's podcast, ideas, hypotheses, opinions, and predictions. And we're bringing in the story of each week. We do a different short story. And what we'll typically do is take a story divided over 2 weeks. So we're picking up the second half of Flannery O'Connor's short story, Everything That Rises Must Converge. And Chris, you picked this story. Can you give us like a recap of where we've been in the last 45 minutes? If you want to, you can actually pause right now and go back. But like the Harry Potter book, sometimes it helps to start by reminding us.
Sure. So Everything Rises Must Converge, or Everything That Rises Must Converge. Julian and his mother are, they're getting themselves ready because Julian's mother's blood pressure is such that she needs to go to a, quote, reducing class, a weight loss class at the Y. And Julian accompanies her because the buses are, quote, integrated. So they've been fussing at each other. It's very clear that Julian is frustrated with his mother and her backwards ways, and Julian's mother is frustrated with her college-age son's book learning, as it were. And so they're about to get on the bus.
I like it. So we can talk about, too, they're having like an existential crisis. And we were talking before we went on the air, we were talking about Waiting for Godot. We were talking about, we haven't talked about Faulkner. I feel like we should talk about some Faulkner. We're talking about James Joyce and the idea of just this search for meaning, which feels like a very Southern Gothic thing. And that's so weird because Southern Gothic, you mentioned Southern Gothic and crime fiction, like it doesn't feel like a thing that it makes sense where search for meaning would be. It's just like, if they wanted to, it could just be like exploitative, like here's some blood and guts stories. But instead, every one of these stories leaves you searching for like this existential, wait, what was the point of all that? And I think that that is somehow more like a psychological thriller than like a horror movie. That's why the Southern Gothic for me works as a genre. I'm interested to hear what about it, the genre or the tropes or the conceits attract you.
Oh gosh, yeah, that's a great question. I could definitely say what drew me to it. I think you touched on some of it right there. You know, I think one of the weirdly compelling things about Southern literature to me was that search for identity. I think that that's one of the reasons why Southern literature is in the company of this kind of gothicism and crime fiction, frankly, which is that, and you know, like you brought up Faulkner, and I think he's extremely important in this too, that there's this sense that Southerners, in a way that later modernists and later writers started to kind of come to terms with it. They were struggling with a sense of identity and a loss of identity a lot earlier than some other American cultures were, right? So you can read Melville and, you know, he even, you know, he just loves talking about Massachusetts and the whaling, you know, and the whaling cultures, and they're all the regionalist,
right? Not for
exactly. And they're all the regionalist writers of the late 19th century. And Southern writers, like as modern fiction was developing, were already dealing with the fact that their whole culture was bankrupt. Like they all had to come to terms with the fact that they had deep identity in something that they really shouldn't have had identity with. And so that's what a lot of Faulkner is about, really, is just kind of coming to terms with the fact that you have all of this culture and identity. And frankly, I think this is very much something that the South is still struggling and dealing with, which is kind of like this one desperate desire to have some kind of identity. And like, I want to have the Confederate flag, and I want it to mean something to me, but it doesn't mean the things that it does. It doesn't mean the things it means, you know. It's like,
right.
And so it leads to this, right. You know, this like, you know, centuries long, you know, awkwardness where Julian speaks to it, right? He's desperate to have this plantation house, but he doesn't want any of the trappings that went along with it, namely slavery. But he still wants that house.
Correct. Yeah. And that's only made possible, like, what is the foundation of that house, right? The foundation is slavery. The foundation is, like, servitude and, like, racism over generations. I'm thinking we're being very mean to Southern folk, and I do apologize if you're from the South. I don't mean to pick on your culture. But if you are flying a Confederate flag and you are upset, I would be like, hey, write me an email and complain. But then I'm like, oh, wait, those people don't listen to podcasts about Flannery O'Connor. Not like, I would also question whether or not they can read and write, but that's a different story, because heritage, not hate. Let's talk about culture in the mind as they're about to get onto the bus, because that's the fight that they're having. And I would say, as an English teacher in high school, this is where a student would point out that they are going to the why. This is almost a little too cheeky, but this family is in some ways looking for their own why. Which is maybe a little too cute, a little too pushed. But here we go on the bus, and we then get on to a lighted bus appears at the top of the hill, and we move into it. I'm interested here, Chris, did you, and I don't know, because I'm reading a lot of O'Connor for this podcast and for life, and talk about like gothic and creepy stuff. Every time they get on a bus or on a ferry or on a streetcar, I am thinking of the idea of Greek mythology going to the underworld and having to pay a toll. Like they're putting the tokens in, or they're like riding with the boatman. You mentioned Faulkner. When the bridge is out, they have to go to the mm-hmm. neighbor's house to cross by the river. And As I Lay Dying, and it's not unsurprising that the neighbor's name is Vernon Tull, mm-hmm. T-U-L-L. But in the Southern, like if you're from the South, Tull sounds like right. Toll, and that's where we are. Like, and they put their tokens in while they're on this ferry ride, or in this case, this bus ride, which is going to lead them into the other world. I'm wondering if that's like a microcosm or something that is an overt or a sly.
Yeah,
illusion.
You know, it's funny. I think, and I don't know if this is just the older I get, the more respect I have for things that appear symbolic or allegorical, because you start to realize that they're both allegorical and not. And this story really, I think, really demonstrates that, because on the one hand, I think you're right. There's, you know, whenever you get onto some kind of, you know, traveling thing there's this journey you're going on. And that's both symbolic and allegorical, and in reference to Western civilization, or, you know, really every civilization. But it's also, that's exactly what it is, you know. And so this story, you know, Everything That Rises Must Converge, you know, this sense where she, you know, earlier Julian's mother had said, you know, I want them to rise, yes, but on their side of the fence. And the kind of, I think, frankly, somewhat deeply Catholic aspect of Flannery O'Connor's writing is that she's saying people are people. And like, it, you know, things are coming together. Like, we're all here together right now. And so this moment of getting on the bus, yes, it's a transport to another world, because it is literally a transport to another world. Like they're both able to just stay in their heads and say their platitudes, and he can be in his impenetrable mental bubble. But they're getting on the bus, and things are about to happen to them that they have no control of.
And it's a great, and it is a great equalizer, mm-hmm. because I think about the O'Connor short story Revelation, where at the end, major spoiler, Mrs. Turpin, I think is her name, has a vision of this like parade up to the sky, almost like the movie Coco, like this bridge to the other world where everyone's walking over. And then like, it's very cool. It's actually like a customs thing. They like, they get their passport stamped and they're dead, so they're able to come through. But it's that, it's like everybody, including the black folk, the white folk, the poor folk, the lame folk, and they're all on the bus or the ferry or the bridge together. And here they are. Like, you could go inside of your head, and he says, sit down in a place where he only looks at the floor, thin feet and red and white canvas sandals. Like, you could stay in your bubble, but that doesn't change the fact that you are on the same bus as anybody else is on, and you're going, as long as you're going, wherever you're going, and you really can't do anything once you get on that bus to change that motion has already kind of been set.
Right, there's the line that was taken... the line at the very end of... This is completely unrelated, but the line from the very end of Barry Lyndon... it was like something like in the reign of George III that these people lived and quarreled, good or bad, handsome or ugly, rich or poor, they are all equal now. And it just, it's this great summation line, like all of this stuff has gone on. It's kind of like, it's just one big shrug in the eons of time.
I gotta love Kubrick, right? I have a lot of thoughts about that too. But here we are. So like, this is cool because they're on the bus, and maybe now I'm overstating it, but as it's a bus ride like to the other world, I do think about heaven and hell, because again, this is my how to read literature like a professor, like 101. If you see people paying a toll, if you see people on a bus or a boat, it's a microcosm, take a note. But when they start remarking on the temperature on their way there,
it's getting hot.
It's getting hot. Oh man, I've never seen it so hot. And it's like... then she says, I don't think it could get any hotter. This other woman with the yellow teeth who feels sort of like ghoulish, almost like in Beetlejuice, the waiting room, right? Like, she's like, no, I believe it could. I reckon it might could get hotter. Could. And it's about to get hotter for these people. But I know for a fact my apartment couldn't get hotter.
Right.
And then speaking of like reminders of sin, reminders of judgment, and I say this like every episode of the podcast, like Flannery O'Connor does not encourage us to judge one another. Quite on the contrary, she creates fictional characters as lenses through which judgment becomes appropriate. So we can say, wow, that was wrong. I should not do stuff
to judge everyone, really.
And that everybody has an equal chance of being both right and wrong. And that black and white thinking is dangerous for everyone, right? So he says, you know, she says, Flannery O'Connor, the author, you know, the two characters are talking. Then the mom says, well, it must get the afternoon sun. Then she sits forward and looked up and down the bus like a quick sly look. It was half filled. Everybody was white. And she says, see, we have the bus to ourselves.
Yeah.
Like what she's saying is not that the bus is to ourselves, that there are no people here, but there are only our people here. And it's that old joke about how does every good racist joke start? And it's with a look over your shoulders so you can make sure that you can
do that's no, that's right? So great.
And that's it.
You know, so you had mentioned last time, you'd kind of brought up the fact that she talks about how she's like, look, I like, you know, I think she calls them darkies. You know, she's like, I try to treat them nicely. I give them money, you know, and you were helpfully contextualizing. And I was just thinking about, and there are so many lines in here that remind me so much of things that are here now. So in reference to that line that she said, there's a museum here in Baton Rouge that is associated actually with the Louisiana State University. It's the Rural Life Museum, and it's a good museum. But there is an extremely strange statue there that is there as a museum piece. And I think they've only recently finally contextualized it. They didn't for the longest time, but this statue is just kind of sitting off to the side. In this museum. And so the Rural Life Museum is like, it's an outside museum where they'll have huts and things from the 19th and early 20th century of just life in rural Louisiana. But anyway, so there's a statue way off to the side, and it's a statue of what could only really be described as an Uncle Tom figure. He is an old black man who's kind of tipping his hat, and the statue says... something like in honor of the good darkies. And so I'm putting this in quotes here, but it's in grateful recognition of the quote good darkies of Louisiana. And I'm trying to remember the rest of it, but essentially this is a statue from the early 20th century, like 1900 or 1904.
It
was a statue in the center of I wish I could. In I think it's Natchitoches, I'm trying to remember where it was. And okay. I think his name is actually, I feel like his name is Uncle Jack. Like, I think his name is Uncle, literally Uncle Jack. The idea, anyway, so it was set up in the center of this town. I think it's Natchitoches. That's a city in northwest Louisiana. And this statue is in the center of town. And it was literally in honor, basically, of the either ex-slaves or other black people who were causing no quote trouble. Statue eventually got taken down, and I'm actually grateful that it's on display for this very reason. I need to know that, like you were like, please tell me this is satire. I'm like, no, this was in the center of the town. And there were some people, it was kind of ironic, there were some people, I think when it was first put up, that were deeply bothered by the fact that they were honoring any black people. Like, right? The irony was, the fight over it was that it was a little too liberal to put this thing up. For the longest time, it was just sitting in the Rural Life Museum. They finally moved it there. But it was without context. So it was like, you know, any kid could just walk up to that, or any adult, frankly, and read that and go, oh, interesting. But they finally, I think, put up a little sign that kind of says this, you know, like, yeah.
By the way,
kind of saying this is something people did.
25 cents to see the minstrel show. You're like, sounds good.
Sorry, this was a long-winded thing. But the aside had to do with the fact that when I first moved down here, and I have to be careful, I guess, with how I say this. We had a neighbor who was an older white woman, and she.
I think she's not listening to the podcast.
She's not probably listening to this. Julian's mom reminds me a lot of her, because she is this like dog whistling kind of person, you know, in the sense that she would say things like this to kind of, you see it as a signal right here. When she says this, the woman responds, right, for a change. I come on one the other day, and they were thick as thieves up front and all through. Mm-hmm. And this neighbor of ours would kind of set out little smoke signals like that to kind of see, like, is it okay if we joke about us being white and better than black people? But she had a man who like did work for her, and she just thought the world of this guy. His name is, I haven't talked to him in a long time, Wilbur. And she had him do literally every little thing, like go do this, go do that, go water this, water that, you know, cut this, trim that, go fix this, go fix that. And he did. And I found out at one point how very little she paid him, but she sure did. She did really care for him, you know, to the extent that she could, you know, not to the degree that I think she paid him fairly, but she, you know what I mean? And not to the degree that she gave him off, during hurricane preparations or, it's funny. I'm just saying this basically to say, like, this feels old and it's not at all. This story feels old and it's not.
It's this forged, like, identity of benign malevolence, it is benign malevolence. It's not that they're being benevolent to these people. It's that you are trying to keep them in their place. You're trying to stop them from rising. You're saying, you can work for me. You can't own your own house. You'll get just enough like a farm or a factory or an indentured servitude. Like, you're never going to get ahead. And I'm interested because you talked about statues. I'm reminded of that story. Did you see that in Richmond, the statue of the African-American like young man with a hoodie and dreadlocks and sneakers? It's on like a Civil War style horse, and it's rearing back, and it's right on the Monument Row right down there in Richmond, which of course has all these statues of these famous generals and these awful people. I shouldn't say awful. No, I can say awful people.
It's all right.
Slave owning equals awful. But like it was made in 2019 by an artist named Kehinde Wiley.
I think I had heard something about this, but I don't think I've ever seen an image of it. Yeah.
So it's called Rumors of War. Stop what you're doing right now and pause the podcast, unless you're driving, which means then don't text and drive. But Rumors of War, the artist name is Kehinde Wiley. And it looks like Robert E. Lee on a horse with the legs rearing
back. Oh, wow,
that is
powerful. Yeah.
But it's a black kid with a hoodie and dreads and like, you know, Jordans. And he's up on this statue right next to all these other Southern things. And I think the purpose of this one, now this is satire. This is a commentary, right? Because, and this is back to O'Connor, because I promise there's a point to this podcast.
I know, I'm
sorry. In the 1950s, no, in the 1950s is when most of these statues commemorating the past actually go up. These Civil War statues that are like the good old days weren't made in like 1868 and in 1872. Like, no, those were traitorous people who were like forced to deny their Southern allegiances in order to get back in the United States. But then like a generation and a half later, it's like, okay, well, now the dust is settled. You know, they were good people too. And with the Klan growing in the South to normalize or mainstream this sort of like this dog whistling of, well, we can make a joke or two, right? Just to see who's out there. It's, well, to honor our relatives, right? Like, that's when this starts to happen, as the South is afraid of the rising of the civil rights movement. And I don't think it's unrelated that we wind up talking about statues and we talk about like cultures and classes in like who is memorialized and who is, to use an awful phrase, like ghettoized, like deliberately kept on their side of the fence. Because that's what the purpose of the civil rights element is. And I think James Baldwin says, and I wish I pulled up the quote before this, but this is good about an extemporaneous podcast. You just sort of like talk right. and figure it out later. I could probably edit it and make it sound like I had it at the ready, but now I'm just gonna roll. He says the greatest enemy of the black man is not the racist, but it is the white man who does things by like half measures. Who's like, yeah, no, we'll get there. He's like, that person is more deadly because at least
right. And it, well, it's Martin Luther King in the Birmingham jail letter too. Right, he says the same thing. Like, I'm not afraid of the racist, really. I know exactly where they stand, but it's the temperate white liberals that were asking. They were asking him to slow down and stop. Like, look, things are getting better. Just, you know, keep quiet. Yeah.
Yeah. Ouch. I have a lot of thoughts. And now I feel really bad if I don't have that quote about James Baldwin's quote exactly right. Because now I'm like, oh my God, if I misquoted it, then even that. And this is a moment checking your own privilege. These are two white educators who are able to be educated by virtue of the fact that our families worked hard and celebrated and stored and saved. But also that there is privilege in our own ancestry. So here we make a podcast talking about books, and it's another white author talking about how to help black folk. And here we have white educators talking about that, like recognizing even in your own pedagogy, your own practice, your own literary analysis, your privilege. Like, hey, I might be wrong about this quote about Baldwin. I thought it was a Baldwin quote. It may be an MLK quote. But even that, it's like the people who need to be heard from are the voices here who are not being heard from, which are, you know, the people who have been marginalized. And because for so long we've created a system whereby – well, the white folks are the college-going folks, and we have here Julian, who's just gone off to college, comes back, and that immediately comes up in the conversation with this lady. Like, oh, he's one of those kids who left outside of town. He's college-educated. He's like somehow has got ahead, and so he sees himself as so woke, not unlike two educators who get together with a day off, and take time from their families and 2.5 children and White House picket fences, all that stuff. But like, what we're doing is in some ways the next generation after it, like. Are you doing enough is the question I think O'Connor is asking. Yeah. That's a very long way to get back to the
no, absolutely. You're right. And we should. So I said, I think last time that, and I stand by this, that I do think this is a great story for the 21st century and for all geographic, multiple geographic responses to racism. Because as much as this has to do with the South, I think Julian especially is very indicative of some white liberal responses, right? And so, and I'm reminded of do you know the Randy Newman song, Rednecks?
You should
check it out. It's powerful, powerful satire.
Okay.
And, but essentially what it is that it's based on a real thing too. I think Randy Newman, it's from the album, I think it's Good Old Boys. And the song Rednecks basically has to do, he's like, he hears this guy on TV making fun of whites in the South being racist. And then he goes on to kind of catalog all of the ways in which the North is doing a lot of the same things, but without directly referencing it, right? So they're, like you pointed out, ghettoizing. So, you know, they're like, yeah, you know, the black man's free in the North to stay on the South Side of Chicago. And so he catalogs all of this kind of fair warning to anybody who's going to listen to it. He does say the N word. I said, it's a powerful piece of art. If you do put it on, make sure you're maybe by yourself. I don't know, O'Connor's really, really attacking both Julian and his mother in this story, I think.
I think so. To ground it in the world of the story, yes. And I think that's it with all of this, which is good because it does lend us that moment of, hey, look, this is a very short story. It's a meditation in a lot of ways. And it's a chance to think about, hey, what in your life have you seen that feels like this? What have you met these characters? She does a really good job of every kid you met who went to college, and you work at a college, Chris, right? Like that first semester when they come home, they want to remind all their provincial mm-hmm. home folk, like that they're Belle back in the little tiny village. They're the one who reads books. Suddenly they have an ironic small tattoo like mm-hmm. on their wrist, or they dress all in black, or they have a beard, or like earrings, and they haven't had that before because they're like culturally new and they're somehow awakened by their time mm-hmm. away from. And as Julian, you know, talks about his time away from college, she, you know, she says what she meant is she sent that she brought him up successfully. He turned out to go to college. He turned out so well. He was good looking. And then every line that she says about him, there's these editorial marks. Well, you know, her teeth had gone unfilled so he could be straightened. He was intelligent, but he realized he was way too intelligent to be a success. And with a future ahead of him, there was, of course, no future ahead of him. Like, there's a little bit of ping ponging there between the narrator's voice and the character's voice. And talking about, like, she believes her son, who is about 30, mm-hmm. I think, which is not a lost moment here. He has a chance to be a Christ figure, to come back and redeem this fallen world, because he's not of this world, is not of this world. And I think that that savior idea, the South finds themselves continually, going back to our earliest discussion, looking for a savior, because they don't know where their foundation is based. It was based in slavery. That's gone. So what can save us? And it naturally leads them to this idea of, well, believe in mm-hmm. Jesus, this very loud, very proud Christianity, which is like a flag waver, which is amazing. But the same people who are like the fundamentalist Christians who surround O'Connor are also the ones who are most entrenched in old Southern aristocracy and racism. So, you know, here we go, right? He believes he was not dominated by his mother. And we meet a parade of people who get up on this bus. Now, it was white folk up until now, but the first person who gets on, surprise, surprise, is a person of color. They mention him as a Negro, well-dressed and carrying a briefcase. He looked around and then sat sort of by himself, and he unfolds a newspaper, which is a sign as a bit of characterization that he's a thinker and a reader, one of the black folk, not a working class version of. He's well-dressed. What do you make of this parade of encounters that starts with this well-educated African-American?
Right.
Like,
right. Well, so yeah, so this is one of those, you know, this is where, you know, the story title really, you know, comes into play, right? This is the moment where their impenetrable bubbles are being penetrated by the outside world and reality. And so, and throughout this entire time, Julian keeps thinking of all of the things he wants this to be like, and it just isn't. You know, he wants to deeply offend his mother. He would have liked to get in conversation with a Negro and to talk with him about art or politics or any subject that would be above the comprehension of those around them, but the man remained entrenched behind his paper. You know, so like, he keeps trying to get his attention. So he finally is like, "Do you have a light?" And then he realizes, it's a non-smoking bus, and he had no cigarettes. So
right. And he's not a smoker, right?
Like, he doesn't have cigarettes. It's no smoking. And the guy just looks at him, and he is irritated. You know, this black man who's gotten on the bus, he lowers his paper and gives him an annoyed look.
Yeah, which again is interesting. So I have a lot of thoughts about this, and I'm thinking about cultural appropriation and of all things, Macklemore.
No, that's great, like, right? Like, slumming, you know, kind of slumming.
Yes, it's like
I'm a smoker.
You know, in Macklemore's whole thing, like, hey, I'm part of the scene, right? It's like, no, you're not. You're trying to like, and a lot of Macklemore's own music is addressing that idea of, he says, you know, in a line about white privilege, his first single off of his first album, he says, "Where's my place in the music that's been taken by my race, culturally appropriated by the white face?"
Yeah,
like what we have here is people who want to be seen as down and hip and with it, yo. And so they put on affectations like blaxploitation, right? And they're just doing it in whiteface. Now we have Julian, who's so college educated, who wants to show off how educated he is. So he wants to talk to one of them literary types. And what he's doing is he's doing it as a show of, look how woke I am. Look how many points I'm scoring off of you, which is no different than mom giving a nickel to a poor black kid. And he says at the end, and it hurts my heart to read it, and I highlighted this time, he says, you know, would have liked to teach her a lesson, would last a while, but there seemed no way to confuse the point. Quote, "The Negro," the Negro, capital T, capital N, "refused to come out from behind his paper." As if it's like the groundhog on Groundhog's Day. Like, he's debased him to animal status there. And like, I, again, we talked earlier about like white educators talking about a story about race and convergence, but like what the narrator is doing here is giving us a hint that the narrator is being cheeky, being dismissive of, well, look at that. The little Negro wouldn't get out. Like, no, the narrator knows what the narrator is doing there. It's somebody who's human, treating somebody as human.
As a pawn, as something to be used.
And there's a very real difference between like somebody who, again, you always justify your own things, but two white folks making an honest effort to try to crack open a story about race and have tough conversations, even though we have like our own privileges and our own biases we speak from, and someone else who's like, if I can just be seen at the Black Lives Matter march with a picture of it on Facebook, I can show all my friends that I'm
not racist. Well, see, I'm glad you said that, you know, because I think that there's so much right there about, especially Macklemore, like, and Julian, that there, I mean, there is a sense that, you know, like, Macklemore definitely means he's definitely trying, and so is Julian, and you know, so there's a part about some of this that I find because I think there's a lot going on in the story that is also not even racial, but it's just personal between Julian and his mother, and Julian and the world, and his mother and the world, and the fact that he cannot see the people in front of him as real people. There's a sense in which this is social and racial. And there's also a sense in which it's a personal penetration, right, into Julian's mind, which is that he is so overly consumed with upsetting his mother and being some kind of image of himself that he can't even just deal with the fact he can't even talk normally. He can't just talk to somebody. Like, he actually might have been able to have a conversation with this man, but he's fumbling through it because he's so insulated into himself.
Well, I think that that line about comparison is a thief of joy. And that's a big thread through O'Connor, is these high and mighty holy rollers who are the worst of them are not the ones who praise God because of their gifts. They praise God for their gifts that they've been given in the face of other people who have not been given these gifts. And it's like, oh, I've got this. Thank God I've got this. No one else has what I has. And it's like, that's going to be a recipe for isolation. He says, use the word here about Julian, detachment. You know, he says he felt completely detached from her. You're treating people as a means to an end, not as an end in themselves. And so what you're doing is like you're othering yourself, you're isolating yourself, and you deserve in that moment to have people call you out on it and be like, dude, you're not here for me. You're here for you. Like, I'm out. You're not putting in the work because you wanna see positive change. You wanna be seen doing the work. And that's not okay. That's not okay. So he says, you know, imagine ways you want to strike up an acquaintance on the bus, but he's talked about time after time after time. He was unable to get people of color to talk to him. Though he does say he would be entirely justified, but her blood pressure would rise to 300, talking about everything that rises. Like, there's a hint again, mom might have a heart attack or a stroke if he brings home too many folks. You know, like, he talks about trying to talk to another one time who was a smoking Negro with a diamond ring on his finger. So again, he sees a sign of wealth and he tries to talk to him when he has no nickels to his name. The Negro rings the buzzer and he's like, I want off. And as he leaves, he gives him two lottery tickets. Like, hey,
yeah. Well, there's almost a sense too, right there, right? So he, one morning he tried to sit down to a distinguished looking dark brown man, right? And it turns out, you know, he was really solid because he was an undertaker. So like, yeah, he's trying, you're right. He's like, there's this, again, you know, repeated, like, he ought to be getting the point at some, you know, that he's meeting real people, but he keeps trying to do it in the wrong way. So he sits down to somebody serious looking. It turns out he's an undertaker. He sits down to somebody who's maybe a little bit richer, but you know, this lottery ticket kind of smacks of this guy might be a gambler of some kind, you know, like, so like he thinks he's rich and maybe, you know, well-to-do, but maybe this guy just likes, you know, gambling for all, you know, so there's no, like, he's trying so desperately for this image and he keeps not seeing the person actually in front of him, including his mother, I might add, because there are repeated references to the fact that she has done quite well for him. Like, she's put him through college and she's like, even in reduced circumstances, he's going to college and he's living in, you know, I think he's living at home, right?
We assume that he's like kind of rent-free, showing up at her house.
Yes, right? He's in his, he's almost 30. He's like, well out of college and should be doing fine. And yet he is living at home with his mother. And this is at a time, incidentally, where, you know, so this isn't any, this, we're not, I'm not casting shade at millennials.
No, do it, man. Do
no,
it.
No, but like,
What are they going to do? Talk about it? Who cares?
But no, but really, you know, like this is at a time where if you had, like, if it's the 60s and you've gone to college, like you really ought to be doing better. And he is a right. he is a real genuine failure here, and he's still mad at his mom, even though she's really trying. She's tried very hard in her life to give him a lot, and he's not even acknowledging that.
We did talk about the Jesus thing too. So he's a 30-year-old, lives at home with his mom, and it's like there we go, right? He also is he wants to be a writer. We learn, but in the meantime, he's selling typewriters quote until he gets on his feet. There's something about that that's not lost on me. That okay, so he has a chance to spread the good news, spread the gospel, spread mm-hmm. the word. But instead, he's sort of just doing something related to the word, but not actually moving the word forward. And I think that that is kind of what he's doing here, where he's like, okay, I'm going to make reparations by somehow talking to a black person who won't ever talk to me. That'll make it better. It's like, no, what are you doing to affect real change, you know, to go out there and have things done without being seen for having
right. Like he's spending his time, right? He says a little bit down there after the his past recollection of all of the black people he's tried to befriend and who have been really irritated with him. Right, he imagined his mother lying desperately ill and his being able to secure only a Negro doctor for her. He toyed with that idea for a few minutes and then dropped it for a momentary vision of him of himself participating as a sympathizer in a sit-in demonstration. This is possible, but he did not linger with it. He's sitting here and he's just and then he's like, ooh, and I could even marry, you know,
I'll bring her a black girl.
And so,
that'll be
and
cool.
all of the so sad part of this, right, is that he could be going to demonstrations, and he could
not.
Be doing anything but thinking about himself and how much he wants to hurt his mom. This reminded me. I'm jumping ahead a little bit because we chatted about this, but so much about this story reminded me of Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and Ulysses, which is not often.
Okay.
Thought of as a sequel, but absolutely is. And one of the hard parts about reading Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, is that, you know, it's hard to fully appreciate the degree to which James Joyce wants you to really see how kind of self-involved and annoying Stephen Dedalus is, you know. And so it's him growing away from his Catholicism and his relationship with his mother and finally leaving, you know, and getting the strength to do that. But Ulysses is such a sad response to this because in the interim his mother has died, and you find out that, and he's tortured with this for the remainder of Ulysses, that he on his deathbed, you know, he was unwilling to kind of throw a bone, as it were, to his mother and kind of let her know that, or he refused to kind of recant his disbelief. And his roommate, who's kind of a bully, but still his roommate's like, why don't you just tell her, like, yeah, I believe in the church again. I'm going again. Like, why'd you have to be mean to her on her deathbed? And he's kind of tortured with this fact that he realizes that he just didn't treat her like a human. He was so high and mighty, and he kind of is starting to be tortured with the fact that he didn't just maybe lie to her just for her own sake. There was so much about this that reminded me of that, because Julian is this 30-year-old who just can't get out of his own head, and as troubled and problematic as his mother is, he can't just be nice to her. Like thinking of ways that he can almost upset her to the point where she will almost have a stroke.
I think everything that you're talking about Joyce and the Dubliners is interesting too, because I'm thinking about Dubliners and thinking about Portrait of the Artist, because so much of Irish literature is, we talk about the Irish boomerang, it sings sad songs about home but never returns, right? Like, you have the chance to go back. There's a story in Dubliners about, like, there's a ball that goes over a wall. They just sort of stare at it like, oh, we should probably get that. Nah, we can't. What can you do? It's like, no, you can begin again. You can go to the sit-in. You can take part in the change. You can, like, you know, use that Gandhi quote, be the change you wish to see in the world. And that's all, like, in the water here for what true social justice could be for Julian. Instead, it's like, yeah, I didn't do it. Well, missed opportunities. What can you do? It's like, what can you do? You can do what you can do. And major, you know, twist at the end of this story, he describes her as the woman, like this woman and this othering, like this, almost as if he says he's already detached from her. That's going to change in like three pages. And the language he uses to describe his relationship with mom. So talking about moms, we have a large hulking woman who steps on the bus. She is African-American. She has a son in a short plaid suit and a Tyrolean hat with a blue feather. They describe her as a giant of a woman with a lower lip that basically says,
"Yeah, not basically, right? Yeah, yeah. It's like that. It's in all like, caps there, right? Don't tamper with me."
There it is here, and she happens to be wearing, what do you know, a hideous hat that is exactly the same as what Mom is wearing. Now that to Julian is the ultimate delight because Mom had said earlier, well, you know, at least with this hat on, I'll never see myself coming and going. It's like, no, here you go. You're wearing a hat, and you're not just wearing a hat. You're wearing a hat of a black lady. Ooh, like it's. I hope you're embarrassed by yourself, because in that moment, what Julian is even doing is he's saying, ooh, I hope you're embarrassed because you're wearing what a black lady would wear, which means that he's not woke. All along, he was harboring that secret kind of haha. They're at a different level than, and like for all of his put-ons that they're somehow equal and somehow involved with the plight of persons of color, he's secretly hoping that someone could be ashamed by seeing that they are in any way similar to
black. And here they're both still, like, after all of this, and even after, like, she shows that, I mean, this woman does not want to be talked to. Like, she is she doesn't want to be messed with, and she is she says sullen looking, like, this woman does not want to be bothered, and they both cannot get past themselves and the symbol that they see her as. You know, so Julian is obsessed at this point with making sure that his mother sees that she's got this hat on.
Yep.
And his mother, for her part, is obsessed with demonstrating her, you know, I think I've mentioned it before, noblesse oblige, her benevolence of giving this kid a nickel when, you know, of course she doesn't have a nickel, just like he didn't have a cigarette or, you know, and so like they're just obsessed with using this woman as a symbol in their game between each other. And not seeing her and not recognizing that they need to leave her alone, she does not want to be bothered.
So there's the scene where they're on the bus and, like, again, white lady and white son sitting apart from one another, not close, not related, not kind, feels very detached. Black lady, black son get on the bus. That son is, in fact, much younger. Right. That lady sits next to Julian, and it says, to his annoyance, she squeezed herself into him. Like, so he doesn't want to actually sit by this black lady. Oops. But the poor black child now sits by the richer white mother. And he says in that moment, he realizes it's almost like they were symbolically swapping children. Like the white lady has the black son, the black lady has the white son. They should have, that alone should have taught the lesson to Mom. But in fact, she doesn't care. She just wants to give the kid a nickel. And the whole bus ride goes, and there's a back and forth to it. Mom, you know, is trying to like get the kid back and forth. She says she kept her eyes on the woman and had an amused smile over her face as if a woman were a monkey that had stolen her hat. That's racist. Then she, the black woman finally gets tired of it. It says, Carver, come here. Like, I don't want you around that lady. And that lady is like, oh, isn't he cute? Blah, 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 blah. But she's like, I'm over it. Like, I don't want my black kid playing around this white lady because that white lady is clearly exploiting the fact that he's like a cute little black kid. So I don't want that happening in my life. And she just, that's it. That should be the end of the conversation. But instead they get off the bus, and Julian knows in this moment, Mom always wants to give a penny to the poor. And because she pities these people, like, oh, it's cute, so I'm going to give a quarter or a nickel. They get off the bus together, and then it really
goes. Well, and there's that line right before that, right? When they're sitting there, when he's recognized the hats, the identity of the two hats. And he said, you know, his grin hardened until it said to her as plainly as if he were saying aloud, although, you know, of course he doesn't. This is part of the irony. He's only ever able to say like little mean things to her. And then when she gets really irritated, he like backs off, like straightens his tie. Yeah. Right. And here all he could do is smile and not actually say, but just kind of indicate your punishment exactly fits your pettiness. And I love that moment because that's what happens to him too. You know, like nobody walks away from this unscathed.
Well, but I think that line too, so this is good. So pettiness and punishment and crime, as they're about to get off the bus, Mom was told to knock it off, quit messing with this boy named Carver. And I think Carver recalls me George Washington Carver. It recalls to me the idea of something that could carve into the heart, like kind of take things apart. But then the mom's like, I see you, even though she was told to stop talking to this kid. The woman slapped, the black mother slaps the kid's hand. She says, quit your foolishness, she said. Now that she's in theory talking to her small child, before I'd knock the living Jesus out of you. And spoiler, she's talking to her kid, but that message is also resonant to the mother here. Because Julian's mom is about to have the Jesus knocked out of her because she just won't stop.
Well, and the really super depressing aspect of this is that, you know, so this mother seems extremely harsh. And I mean, is she's slapping this 4-year-old's hand, but the, you know, you're right. Like, she's also talking to Julian's mother. Julian's mother does not recognize the danger inherent in her black son interacting with her in any way.
Yeah.
And this mother is doing what she absolutely needs to do, which is teach him, do not mess with white people. Do not mess with white ladies, especially. Do not take nickels from them. Do not get comfortable with them. They will appear to be benevolent and kind to you. They will report you to their husbands later. It's wolf whistle, exactly, right?
It's
Trayvon Martin. It's ongoing, yes. Right? And she's teaching him, like, this is not safe. And you're right. She's kind of half talking to Julian's mother as well. But it's like, this is not a safe interaction. This interaction should not continue. And you are conditioning him into being treated like one of the quote good darkies that you can give money to, until it backfires on you, and then you'll have him lynched.
Yeah, and that's Chris. I mean, like, this is there's no moment in this story that it gets lighter.
No, yeah,
it just gets emotionally darker and darker and darker as we go. So as they get off the bus, you know, she wants to give a dollar or a nickel or a quarter, and Julian's like, "Don't do it!
Hissing.
Don't do it!
Yeah.
Don't do it!" No. But mom can't stop. He says again, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. Like, she has been warned. She does it anyway. The huge woman, you know, stands like a machine, then looks at her all at once and explodes like a piece of machinery had just been given an ounce of pressure too much.
Everything
that rises.
Yeah.
The blood pressure we talked about earlier, now we have the ounce of pressure in a machine. The woman's black fists swing out with a red pocketbook, and she just, like, smacks grandma in the chest or mom in the chest and, like, knocks her over. He don't take nobody's pennies. When he opened his eyes, the woman was disappearing down the street with a little boy staring wide-eyed on her shoulder, and Julian's mother was sitting on the sidewalk. I don't know if she punched her.
I know. You never know, right? I think about that line a lot, too.
But whatever that explosion was, physical, emotional, like mental, it ends with shock and awe, and now mom is dropped to her knees on the ground.
And you know, it's just like Good Country People, right? Oh, wait, which is the one with the misfit? That's Good Country People, yeah.
A good
man is hard to find. I'm sorry, yeah. So, it's just like that moment, like you said. Like, it's such a shame that it takes this, but it does. You see repeatedly that both of them are not being penetrated, right, by the outside world. They're not getting the signs. He's not recognizing that he's talking to an undertaker. He's not recognizing that this guy wants to be left alone, and she's not recognizing, and it takes that one ounce of pressure too much. It takes that moment where she has to shout and hit her pocketbook, right? It takes that, and it shouldn't, but it did.
And at that point, by the time you realize it, it's that end of your life moment, because the son says, I told you not to do that. His first response is not to mom, like, hey, are you okay?
Right.
It's, I'm going to scold you for this. He repeats again, gritting his teeth. You got exactly what you deserve. Now get up. And then he gets in. I hope this teaches you a lesson. Like, come on, let's go. Don't think I was just an uppity Negro woman. That's a whole color race. We'll no longer take your condescending penny.
Which is funny, because, like, it's not. It is actually just a woman who is really irritated with him.
Oh, my God. And the thing is, and that's him being so, in that moment, racially tone deaf. But 4 paragraphs earlier, he says, he sighed, rising above them on either side were black apartment buildings marked with irregular rectangles of light. What they're doing there is pointing out, like, he overgeneralizes that there's blackness and there's whiteness and this is all about race. This was, in this moment, mom being well-intentioned and misguided that cute kids are cute kids, so I'm going to do it. She has racist tendencies for sure, but in this moment she wasn't thinking about this black kid is cute because he's black. She was just doing what old ladies do, like, I'll report her to a kid.
Yeah.
And he makes it a racial thing because he's triggered because he's woke, right? And in his cancel culture, he wants to remind mom, you know, I hope you're happy. That was your black double. She could wear the same hat as you and me. And then he thinks it's funny. So he says, and it looked better on her than you anyways. So your whole world is gone, lady. You know, old manners are obsolete. Your graciousness ain't worth a damn. And then he thinks about that bitter house that had been lost for him. You aren't who you think you are. You don't think, you know, like, it's like he's trying to, like, stick it to her, like, and use the language of the child's name to carve her up with this. Like, you don't think the world's come to an end. from now on, you got to live in a new world, face new reality streams.
Buck up, it won't kill you, but it might. Right? You know, and yeah, exactly. And all through this, he's starting to get exactly what he deserves, which is that he wanted this. He wanted her broken. He wanted her.
Yes.
He wanted this. And he's starting to see it. And it's, you know, it's sad. She crumples. Mm-hmm. And he dashes forward and falls at her side crying, "Mama, Mama," which is like, I've always been super affected by this ending because he's so cruel to her the entire story. And she crumples and he just runs to her yelling, "Mama, Mama." And it's like, it's heartbreaking mm-hmm. because, you know, for all of the racial things we've been talking about, this is such a deeply human story, because exactly, like, they've switched places here. She's just wanted yep. to give a quarter to a kid, and he has misidentified this woman as emblematic of the entire and all of Black America. And in reality, what's mm-hmm. happening, he's being extremely mean to his mother, and she is having a stroke, and it's all coming crashing down to him, or it's all converging, it's all coming crashing together.
It converges, right? You know, and it goes in that line. It talks about converging and rising and falling. He starts by calling her mother, which is what he called her earlier when he felt detached from her. That's mm-hmm. a very formal mm-hmm. way to
right.
describe her. Then darling, sweetheart, wait.
That's like, I know, right?
Like a relationship, like a love, like a romance. And then from that, like from the super formal to like the casually intimate mama, to like mama,
yeah, yeah.
mama. Like in that moment, he's reduced to a child.
Right.
He's crumpled to the ground. And in that moment, she has a stroke or a heart attack. And she pretty much dies on the sidewalk. And at that moment, it's yeah. too late. The end.
He's shouting, but his voice was thin, scarcely a thread of sound. One thing that I think is so interesting about that is that he's been voiceless. I mean, he's done everything in his head. He's only ever, you almost get the sense it's hard to know if she ever heard him. You know, because he was yep. hissing and saying through his teeth. And you get the feeling that she's learned to ignore this. You know what I mean? Like, she's yeah. learned to ignore his little mutterings under his breath because he's just doing it to be mean to her. So she started to ignore it. Maybe she would have stopped. But by the time he's actually calling yeah. for help, he doesn't know how anymore.
Well, I think that goes back to Catholic theology. And this is, you know, I mean, as we're kind of wrapping up the podcast, the idea of, like, grace is freely offered, but it must mm-hmm. be accepted. That if God loves you is a very Catholic understanding of the world. Like, God offers you the chance for redemption at all times. Like, you never are in a black or a white with God. You have a chance for like owning what is yours and saying, hey, this is my chance to come back and say I could do better. There has to be free choice of God's love for you, because in theory, God loves you so much, God gives you free will. If God exists, mm-hmm. right, then the whole idea is he loves you enough, you can do whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do it, up to the last moment of. But our guy here believes himself to be so high and mighty, so superior, he doesn't authentically seek to engage mm-hmm. with anybody. He just sits in his ivory tower, impenetrable, and says, oh, I can't believe how
right, right.
people are. Oh, I can't believe how broken they are. But he doesn't give them that opportunity to, like, you know, sit with them, to be with them, to commune with them. And we started the podcast off and we were slagging on, you know, racists and slagging on people from like the Confederate flag flying south. But like, you know, if you dismiss people as like the
yeah,
MAGA
yeah.
crowd, right? Like, they can't possibly hear me. Then how do you make the world right. better? If you dismiss people as the crazy liberals, like whether it's Fox
yeah.
News or CNN,
no, you're right.
what you do. Once you label people, once you yep. lump them, you deny them the chance to be human, to be graceful, and
right.
be redeemed. And it's only in that radical last moment where they become no atheists and foxholes. It's like, oh my God, but doesn't even have time to process it because he spent all that time just putting that toxic.
Yeah, yeah, I'll own to this publicly and vocally. You know, I have that problem. You know, I definitely have that problem. I will absolutely, and social media is very bad for this, right? Because you are able to make people symbols and anonymous and some yep. not real human person. And I'll be reminded of this whenever I get into an actual physical, which, you know, is harder these days, physical argument with somebody, right? Where you realize, okay, this person has like, there is a thought process behind this, and I need to try to figure out what that is so that we can actually like move past this. But it's so hard when it's just a faceless person that you're treating as a symbol of something rather than as a human. And it's hard for both sides. Like on social media, it's just two people symbolizing the other and not seeing the real human there. And then you have that last moment that, you know, you realize for as innocent as his mother was, he, and as worldly as he appeared, he was the innocent one, right? He's the innocent one who's not been able yeah. to fully see the world and fully or naive, yeah,
right? Yes.
And so that moment right there, like, you know, I mentioned Joyce, and this reminds me so much of a Joycean line, both in tenor and in theme. The tide of darkness seemed to sweep him back to her, postponing from moment to moment his entry into the world of guilt and sorrow. And it's such a tragic line, because, you know, he is entering into that Stephen Dedalus of Ulysses, who is just tortured with his own cruelty and lack of real interface with the world and his mother.
Hey, Chris, next time we do this, can we pick a happy story?
I know, right?
This was not that. This is the opposite of that. Oh my God. All right. Well, I leave. Maybe I want to be a better person. I feel like I got to like go to church or take a shower. Like,
something, right?
But they closed churches, and I don't know. I also forgot how to wear a belt because I've been in quarantine for so long. I don't know how to wear any good sweatpants. But I want to thank you for coming back on the podcast today. Are you on social media or on the internet that people can find you somewhere?
I sure hope to be someday. I do need to be better about my social media presence, and I hope to be more active on Twitter. Okay. I do have a website, chrismichelski.weebly.com, that you can contact me in any way and see some of the stuff that I've been up to.
Great. Thank you for that. And I would say about Twitter too. So you mentioned social media, sort of my dig at social media. I told somebody one time, like, Twitter is like a highway built exclusively for short attention spans. Like, you get digital honks from people who will retweet you,
yeah,
and you feel like you're great. And then quietly, people who see your bumper stickers and don't like them, they cuss you out and they flick you off.
Right.
But like, they say it in a place that you'll never hear it. So maybe you're wrong, and maybe you're right that social media is, overrated. That said, if you want to message me on the social, I'm at MeehanEDU. That's Meehan, like my last name, and EDU, like teaching. I love both of those things, my family and learning. So please, let's connect. If you want to be on the podcast, that's awesome. Message me. Leave a like, a comment, subscribe. It helps other people find it. And we'll see you next time on the podcast. Thank you again, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the chance. I really appreciate it.
You got it. Thanks again, guys. Bye for now.